Hello and welcome back to PaleoCast. I'm Dave Marshall.
And I'm Joe Keating.
Well, today we've got an interview I recorded with Dave Rudkin, a curator at the Royal Ontario Museum in Canada, back in June.
I've always wanted to visit the Royal Ontario Museum.
It's actually a really nice museum, and they've got some good displays on the museum's floor, as well as the collections behind the scenes. And I hear that they're actually currently looking to expand the paleontological displays to show off some of the more important fossils and not just the crowd pleasers.
So I guess it's one of these important fossils that you were talking to Dave Rudkin about.
Yeah, although the fossil we're discussing is in a different museum, it's still quite a significant specimen though. But I'll let him tell you the story of his discovery. Within the whole geological record, few fossils are as instantly recognisable as the humble trilobites. Perhaps the reason for this is because these extinct arthropods are relatively common in rocks of a certain age across the world. They were one of the first major groups to appear in the fossil record during the well-known Cambrian explosion. They continued to diversify into the Ordovician before a prolonged decline would finally see them die out during the Permian-Triassic extinction event, in which up to 96% of all marine species went extinct. Though they possess a long and complex history, their bodies are remarkably simple. Trilobites possess only three functionally differentiated sections: the cephalon, head, thorax, body, and pygidium, tailpiece. Although seemingly simple in form, the variability that can be built into this simple body plan is such that over 20,000 unique specimens have so far been identified. The variation isn't only limited to different shapes, number of segments, or spinosity, but it can also be reflected in a surprisingly large range of sizes. Whilst the vast majority reached more than a couple of centimetres in length, a few existed that were comparable giants. Here to discuss Isatelus rex, the king of trilobites, is Dave Rudkin from the Royal Ontario Museum, Canada. So, first of all, thanks very much for joining us today.
My pleasure.
Could you tell us a bit about yourself, what you do here at the ROM?
Well, my official title is Assistant Curator of Invertebrate Paleontology, but that covers a whole host of evils. I have a research component to my job, clearly working on fossils, and mostly on fossil arthropods, trilobites, but also horseshoe crabs, eurypterids, and a variety of other things as well. But I've worked on plants, and I've worked on mollusks, and I've worked on the Burgess Shale, and so there's really no narrow confines in which I'm kept. But I do a lot of other things as well. I'm an educator, and I have a cross appointment with the University of Toronto, where I've been a lecturer in paleontology for about 20 years now. I do a lot of public programming for the museum and for other related institutions and organizations. So getting the word out on geosciences in general, but paleontology specifically, is one of the things that I really like to do. And then, of course, there's the usual curatorial stuff that actually goes along with that job title, which is building collections here at the Royal Ontario Museum in paleontology, maintaining those collections, making them accessible to not only legitimate researchers, but also in various ways to the public through displays and long-term galleries and so on. So it's a broad kind of job title that covers many, many things, and I've been doing it for probably far too long to at this stage of the game, about 40 years now.
Okay, so we've all heard of T-Rex, but I-Rex? I mean, is this trilobite anywhere near as terrifying?
No, of course not. The T-Rex, the terrifying part of that, of course, Tyrannosaurus rex, is the Tyrannosaurus, which means tyrant lizard. Mm-hmm. I-Rex, Isatelus rex, it just means the king of the Isatelans. Of course, Isatelus is a relatively common let me rephrase that. Isatelus is one of many kinds of trilobites that have a very similar pattern, show up through the middle to late Ordovician. characterized by a head and a tail of roughly equal sizes. So that's okay. the cephalon and the pygidium, or cephalon and pygidium. That's what isotelus means, equal ends. So this is just the king of the equal-ended trilobites, basically. Not terrifying at all. Aside from potentially its large size compared to both other isotelin trilobites and to trilobites in general. So it was big, that's all.
So it is the largest trilobite. So how big is it exactly?
It's intact, more or less. All of the pieces are there, as far as we can tell, of the dorsal exoskeleton. That's the part that you usually find. And it measures from the tip of the head, the cephalon, to the back of the tail, as far as it's preserved, about 700 millimeters, 70 centimeters. It's about 28 inches in length.
So that's about the size of a medium-sized dog, I guess.
It's pretty big. It's over 2 feet long in non-metric terms. We like the 700 millimeter part because it just sounds even bigger. And people have, when it's put in print as an outline drawing, it's been compared to the size of a standard house cat, which it dwarfs, and to an umbrella, standard umbrella, of which it's almost the same length. So it's a big trilobite. I think for me, most impressively, is that the largest trilobite known prior to this, largest complete trilobite, was about 43 centimeters in length, and Isotelus rex, its width is 46 centimeters. So it is wider than the previous record holder was long. So that kind of puts it in perspective for me.
So you say it's not complete. So can you estimate about?
We could probably add another 20 millimeters to the 700. So it comes out to about 72 centimeters in length, 720 millimeters. And that's because when we found the fossil exposed in a very nasty setting on the shore of Hudson Bay, one portion of the tail had already been broken away as part of the normal erosion process and lost forever. So we can just extrapolate by continuing the curve of the edge of the tail around and measure out that extra 2 centimeters or 20 millimeters to give us an estimated 720 millimeters in total length. But other than that, head's there, all 8 thoracic segments, both lateral pieces of the head, the free cheeks are in place. The tail is there except for that missing bit about the end. We don't know if the hypostome, that's the ventral plate sitting beneath the head and around the mouth area, is still there because we haven't bothered to prepare this monster from underneath yet to find out. I wouldn't be surprised if it was there, but and so far we haven't found a non-destructive technique which will allow us to view inside the block of dolostone in which this is contained sufficiently well to give us an image of the inside. So that's as much as we know now.
Okay, so you say that you first found the tail sticking out of the rock. Who was it that found it? Was it yourself?
It was me, and it was more than the tail. I think if it had just been the tail, I might not have noticed it quite as quickly. It was about two-thirds exposed.
Okay. Well, that's still quite a lot, isn't it?
It was enough to tell us it was a damn big trilobite, and actually enough to tell us what kind of a trilobite it was. And there's a whole bunch of serendipity involved in any discovery of this nature, but I had already been working on other kinds of isotelin trilobites for many years, and so I was able to recognize it fairly quickly as being a representative of that group. I was also able to tell from what was exposed on the beach at the time that this was awfully big, much, much bigger than anything I'd ever seen before. So I literally stepped on it as I was walking along this coastal outcrop and did a double take, said a few unmentionable words, and ran about another half kilometer back along the beach to find the rest of the crew to bring them back, who all uttered unmentionable words when they saw it, and that was the sort of beginning of the.
So what were you actually looking for if you weren't looking for Isotelus?
I was looking for trace fossils, trilobite trace fossils. Now, and we'll have to go back a little bit here. The place that we were looking had gained some notoriety in Canadian paleontological circles because one very large isotelin trilobite had been found there previously.
Okay.
And it was the one it was 430 millimeters long.
Okay, so the previous biggest.
The previous record holders. And given the fact that several researchers and sets of geologists and paleontologists have been looking at this exposure, this coastal exposure, over a period of many, many decades, and only one of these large trilobites had ever been found. I wasn't there to find more trilobites. Mm-hmm. What I was interested in was the fact that at least two previous researchers had reported on very large trace fossils that they thought may have been associated with the activity of these large isotelian trilobites. So that's what I was looking for. My colleagues from the University of Manitoba and the Manitoba Museum were primarily coral workers. So they were clustered around little tiny corals attached to boulders on this beach and doing their thing while I was out looking for trace fossils. So I guess there was a trilobite theme involved, mm-hmm. but I was looking for these very large traces, and discovering the trilobite, the big trilobite, was pure serendipity, completely accidental. So it was the reason for being there was sort of multifarious. It's a very unusual geological setting, but my premise for being there was certainly not to discover big trilobites.
Okay, so after you did find it, after you had your little celebration, how did you actually manage to get it out of the rock? Because a 70-centimeter slab of just rock is going to weigh half a ton, surely.
It did weigh a lot by the time we got it out. Without going into too much detail, the place where we found this is actually in the intertidal zone of shoreline and Hudson Bay. Hudson Bay, of course, is the big body of salt water that extends right down through central Canada, brings the Arctic down into the middle portion of Canada, in fact. So it's not a particularly hospitable place. It's tidal, and in this area around Churchill, Manitoba, the tides can be fairly substantial, depending on the time of year and the winds. Mm-hmm. This trilobite found on the shoreline was actually exposed at low tide. And we found it as the tide was, or we first discovered it when the tide was dropping. By the time we got ourselves organized and collected our thoughts, the tide was coming back in again, and it very quickly went right back over the trilobite. The next tidal cycle, low tidal cycle, wasn't until much later that day. In fact, in the late evening, which isn't too much of an issue because we're far enough north that the days are quite long at that time of year in the summer, so we could actually work on the outcrop probably until 10:30 at night in decent light, as long as there are no polar bears around, which is the other issue that we have to deal with. So we came back that evening, but it was the weather had changed drastically, and there was, even at lowest tide in the evening, we had an onshore wind with a storm front moving through, so at low tide it was still under water. So we had to wait until the next morning. The weather cleared, fortunately, and we timed our arrival as the tide was going out. So we stood and watched the trilobite being uncovered by the tide, which meant we had about an hour and a half total before the tide turned around and came back in again. So we weren't prepared, obviously, when we had arrived in Churchill that year for field work to do any major excavation. We had no power tools, no saws, no jackhammers, nothing like that. We had hammers, chisels, and a pry bar. And a small sledgehammer. So we went to work as quickly as we could, realizing that we had a relatively limited amount of time to get this out tide-wise, and also because of the shifting sands on the shoreline. There's no guarantee that when you come back, that part of the intertidal zone is actually going to be exposed rock. Fortunately, although the next morning we did have enough of a window to get this out, and we went to work, first of all, uncovered by removing the overlying portions of the trilobite to see exactly how much was there, whether the two-thirds that we saw exposed was it, or whether there was more. And to our great delight, everything else was there. We uncovered the anterior portion of the head, the front portion of the head, so it was all intact. Genital angles were all intact. The lateral sides of the thorax were all intact. So it was just missing that little tiny bit or chunk out of the tail, which... little tiny is relative, of course, when you find a big trilobite. About the size of about a quarter of the size of a standard pie was missing. So we did manage to get it out in two main pieces and several small pieces by working frantically and taking turns with sledgehammers and chisels. Moved it up out of the the low or the tidal zone so that we could work on bagging and protecting the rest of the parts before we had to carry it out. It's about slightly longer than a kilometer walk in to this site from the nearest place we could get a vehicle across a very high quartzite ridge, which bounds the coastline there, and across a bit of tundra, so through a marsh. So we split it up and switched the loads back and forth, got it back to the truck, and then managed to get it back to our base of operations, which is the Churchill Northern Studies Center, which has another long story attached to it. I won't tell here.
So what kind of rocks did you say it was preserved in?
These are Upper Ordovician in age, so the age is Late Ordovician. The rock unit itself is a very fine-grained dolostone. So the mineral dolomite makes up the primary component of this. So it's effectively, it's a carbonate rock. Dolostones don't usually preserve fossils all that well, but here there's a different story. Preservation is quite remarkable. These are flat, well, they're slightly dipping beds of these dolostones that drop out into Hudson Bay. They shingle down into and underneath the bay, so they could probably come up with an actual dip if I thought about it really hard, but I won't. So they shelve off underneath the coast, and so there are these successive ledges that build down towards the waterline, the coastline. And this was exposed on one of these ledges that had very fortunately probably only been exposed by erosion within the previous, probably no more than a year, because this would have been completely destroyed had it been exposed longer. This is, it's an active coastline, actively eroding under the influence of tides during the summer, of course, and shifting sands, but this is also a place that's covered by ice for right. most of the year. This is the polar bear capital of the world, Churchillians claim, and it's the ice conditions that bring these bears on shore, and they wait for the summer months, they wait for the ice to build in the fall, and then they can go back out and hunt on the shelf ice during the winter months. And that ice is there, well, it can be there until July, and then leave for a space of perhaps 2 months, and then build back in October again. So it's a very nasty place to be exposed on the beach if you're a fossil. You're going to get ground up, chewed up, broken, carried away, or walked on by bears, when, which keeps paleontologists away, I suppose.
So sedimentary rocks can really give us an idea of the ancient environment as kind of like fossilized landscapes. So are we able to paint a picture of Manitoba in the Ordovician?
Certainly this part of Manitoba, this modern-day Churchill and the region in this part of the Hudson Bay Lowlands, of course, is subarctic by modern climatic standards, but it certainly wasn't that during the late Ordovician, so about between 445 and 450 million years ago. The bit of continent on which Manitoba resides today, which we call Laurentia during that interval of time, was rotated clockwise, lay across the equator, and Manitoba was, what we now call Manitoba, lay in south tropical to subtropical climes.
All right.
And sea levels were extremely high, so they flooded onto the interior of this ancient continental landmass. The area around Churchill was actually an island archipelago, so there are these little high spots of very, very ancient rocks, Proterozoic rocks about 2 billion years old or so, approximately, that stood up as islands in these shallow Ordovician seas. And the region where the large trilobite was found and we were collecting other fossils were animals that were alive in this shallow rocky beach area along the margin of one of these big paleo islands. So we can reconstruct the environment in great detail because these are very, very fossiliferous rocks. In addition to big trilobites, there are also small trilobites, several different kinds of smaller trilobites, an abundance of corals, a huge diversity of corals, bryozoans, brachiopods, nautiloid cephalopods, almost all of the things that you would expect to find in any standard late Ordovician, upper Ordovician fossiliferous setting. So we can put together a very detailed picture of the kinds of organisms that were alive at the time. We can read back paleolatitude, get a good sense of paleoclimate, build the ecology up, and we've done this in a very dramatic fashion, or my colleagues at the Manitoba Museum have, by creating a beautiful digital animation of this rocky shoreline, which includes Isotelus rex as a living organism, all of the corals reconstructed in life mode, a highly active, dynamic, shallow marine setting. And it's the picture that we can retrieve from these fossils and from the rocks and from the paleogeography is really, really very, very detailed.
Is Isotelus the only taxon in this environment to be this big? I mean, is there any reason why it could get so big?
We're not quite sure on that one. That's still a very, very interesting story. Everything else in the biota there, the fossil biota, and that includes, I use the word biota rather than fauna, because not only do we have fossil animals of many different kinds, we also have a variety of algal fossils that are quite well preserved that allow us to build that picture in. And these are non-calcified algae. Often the ones that we're finding there didn't carry minerals in their algal phallus when they were alive. So the fact that we've got them preserved there at all is quite extraordinary. And in other parts of the section very close to this, we find a number of things that are non-biomineralized animal fossils as well, things that didn't have minerals in their exoskeletons or in their endoskeletons or in their protective structures while they were alive. And why they happen to be preserved there is yet another story. But as far as we can tell from the fossils that are associated directly or very closely with Isotelus rex, nothing else is of extreme size. Everything else seems to be just as you would expect it to be. There are some large coral colonies, but we see large coral colonies elsewhere in the late Ordovician. There are some large nautiloid cephalopods, but they're a feature of many middle to late Ordovician standard marine settings where you get big orthoconic nautiloid cephalopods that can reach 1, 2, 3, or 4 meters in length. So those are all standard animals and plants for this time. Only Isotelus rex, even among the trilobites, stands out as being abnormally large. And no, I have no idea why that should be the case, except that Isotelus in other parts of the world, in the late Ordovician particularly, seems to be able to attain much larger than average trilobite size. There are some very large Isotelan trilobites known from approximately coeval rocks in the mid-continent of the U.S., in the Cincinnati area, in Ohio. Some 40-centimeter-long Isotelus are known there. Even here in Toronto, probably a few kilometers from where we sit, there was a quarry that actually operated within the Upper Ordovician rocks that underlie, the bedrock that underlies Toronto, and large Isotelus of 25 to 30 centimeters in length were extracted from there in the last part of the, or in the last century. So Isotelus itself was capable of getting big, but why at Churchill, or what we now call Churchill, why in that environment represented by the rocks around Churchill today do we find the biggest trilobite confirmed, largest trilobite known? We don't know. Something very peculiar, clearly, related to the environment specifically there, seems to be at work. I should mention that there are competitors for the world's largest trilobite now, certainly in Ordovician rocks, in older Ordovician rocks. There's a wonderful site in Portugal, Arouca, that has produced some very, very large trilobites, including Asaphan trilobites that are of Isotelan pattern. But I don't think there's been one yet confirmed, complete one, undistorted one yet confirmed that reaches the 720 millimeter length. So there are large trilobites elsewhere. So some of the features of the environment at Churchill must have been in operation elsewhere, or different ones, different environmental parameters that gave rise to these larger, or these growth spurts for some of these trilobites. But it's still a little bit of a mystery.
Well, there's a link between increased atmospheric oxygen and arthropod gigantism in the Carboniferous period. And so this was observed in some of the terrestrial species. But is it possible that an increased atmospheric oxygen could result in this size increase? Was the climate that different? Did it have increased oxygen in the Ordovician?
No, actually, it's quite the opposite in the Ordovician. As best we can tell, and of course this is an ever-changing data set, that climates in the Ordovician were quite warm globally, at least the earlier part of the Ordovician, for some substantial time through the Ordovician. has been touted as the sort of ultimate greenhouse climate. It was among the warmest climates ever achieved on the planet for a sustained period of time. But during that same interval, oxygen levels were lower than they were, certainly during the Carboniferous, and probably lower than they were for much of the Paleozoic. In contrast, CO2 levels, carbon dioxide levels in the atmosphere, were very, very high for much of the Ordovician. So that's exactly the opposite that you see in the Devonian and Carboniferous, where hypoxia or elevated oxygen, atmospheric oxygen levels have been linked to, quite convincingly in some cases, to arthropod gigantism among terrestrial species. But this terrestrial arthropods are very different than marine ones. They operate, obviously, in different systems. Being an air dweller on the surface of the Earth is quite different than being an aquatic organism supported by a non-compressible fluid, living in water. Gravity, there are issues of gravity and so on and so forth, and the availability of dissolved minerals to build exoskeletons. The very, very large terrestrial arthropods that feature in the Carboniferous, some of these big arthropleurids, millipede centipede-like, because they weren't, but they certainly have some features in comparison, and the very large meganeuran dragonfly-like insects. They lived in a very different manner than trilobites did. Trilobites being completely and utterly reliant upon marine ecosystems to support them. We can't really make those close comparisons with gigantism in Carboniferous terrestrial forms and this one instance of gigantism in the late Ordovician marine record. We've hypothesized a little bit, waved our arms around some of the possibilities for why Isatelus rex was able to grow so large. It may have had to do with the tropical setting. Many large marine arthropods today live in tropical settings, but the largest are often associated with very, very cold climates today, quite the opposite. So it's still a bit of a conundrum, but we don't think that atmospheric oxygen levels, elevated or otherwise, were involved in gigantism for Isatelus rex.
Okay, so we've had its environment, we've had the climate and how big it was, but what do we actually know about Isatelus and how it lived? How did it feed? I mean, if it's this big, it must have got through a lot of food.
One would hope that it was utilizing a food source that was helping to accelerate the growth. And of course, the thing we have to deal with any arthropod getting big is the fact that they don't just grow in a smooth, continuous fashion. Arthropods have to molt. They wear their skeletons on the outside of the bodies. Whether those skeletons are mineralized in life, such as in trilobites, or whether they're non-mineralized cuticles, such as many of the terrestrial forms, they have to get out of those boxes that they live in on an incremental basis, expand their soft, unmineralized, or unhardened bodies to a larger size, and then rebuild a rigid cuticle or a mineralized exoskeleton around those bodies. So that's metabolically a very expensive thing to do, and obviously requires a reliable food source, among many, many other things. So as far as Isatelus rex is concerned, we have some clues as to how it may have made a living. They were benthic animals. That means they lived on the seabed, certainly as adults. A 70-centimeter long trilobite wasn't swimming. No matter what the other environmental context was, they probably weren't spending a lot of time up in the water column. They were armored tanks on the seafloor, so they were in contact with the seafloor, and clearly that's where they were deriving their nutrition. And as many trilobites obviously did, as larval trilobites, isatelans probably spent at least their post-embryonic stage on the seafloor. Early stages may have been up in the water column. They had these very peculiar little earliest growth stages that look like little inflated footballs with spines that probably were planktic. But that's an entirely different component of their life cycle. As adults, when they had built this standard exoskeletal box of a head and a tail with 8 thoracic segments in between. They were crawling around on the bottom, and so the bottom was their source of food. And one can imagine that they were probably seeking mostly soft-bodied food sources, so scavenging around on the bottom or hunting on the bottom for living prey or dead and decaying organic matter, and grasping that between the bases of their legs that meet along the midline of the animal, their paired limbs, passing it forward to the mouth. There's no mouth parts that could actually do any chewing in trilobites, but they use the bases of their legs that were often carried stiff spines to maybe break up softer food and sort of pre-masticate it before they pumped it into their mouths. So one can imagine these things going along, picking up maybe small clams, small shrimp-like animals, maybe marine worms, basically anything that it could grasp between those the bases of its legs and pass forward into the mouth. Probably not actively hunting and tracking things down. And one of the primary clues we have to their behavior on the bottom are the trace fossils that I mentioned a little bit earlier on that had been noticed by previous researchers and published in the literature. And we went back looking specifically for those and have gone back in many subsequent years to look at these trace fossils, which are correspondingly very large. We have trace fossils that we are pretty sure were made, or almost certain were made by Isatelus rex. Traces that match the width of the largest known specimen. So these traces are 40 or more centimeters in width. They can often be traced along bedding planes for several meters in continuous motion. They were made, as best we can tell, by large trilobites working their way along the bottom, digging with their limbs into the shallow, what would have been mud at the time, fine mud, probably creating a slurry of mud beneath themselves in order to find these soft-bodied things that may have been burrowing into the soft sediment for shelter, making these large furrows on the seafloor. We can track them in a straight line. We can watch these trace fossils, and hence the trilobite that made them, take a sharp right-angle turn, then move again with another sharp right-angle turn in the opposite direction, so making these very zigzaggy kinds of traces. Smaller traces of the same pattern can go on for 2 or 3 meters in a straight line. We have ones that loop back on themselves. So we can see a set of complex behaviors on the seafloor, probably related to this furrowing activity in a search for food. And so that gives us some sense of the way these animals were behaving on the seabed. I should also mention we have some traces that are actually wider than 40 centimeters, pushing 50 centimeters in width, you cannot necessarily match the width of an animal with the width that it makes exactly, because there are often processes that push sediment aside and make the trace look bigger than the actual width of the animal. But potentially there were even bigger trilobites there, which we haven't found body fossil evidence for yet. Which is why we keep going back to Churchill, or one of the reasons we keep going back to Churchill.
Although Isatelus is the largest trilobite ever discovered, it's not the largest arthropod ever discovered. So that's actually Jacalopterus, which is a sea scorpion from the early Devonian of Germany, and that's estimated to be around 2.5 metres or 8.2 feet. Do you think it's possible that we'll find even larger arthropods in the future?
I think we're pushing the limits, both in terms of Eurypterids, certainly at that length. I always like to point out that when you measure a trilobite exoskeleton, you measure the trilobite exoskeleton, the bodies contained within that box. Some trilobites have very, very long spines that extend backwards from the tail. So we try not to measure those when we measure body length. Eurypterids, when they're measured at full length, they usually, especially for these big pterygoid eurypterids, it includes that massive feeding or chelicerae that stick out the front end. So you're actually measuring appendages as well as body length for these big eurypterids. Not that that takes away from an 8-foot-long eurypterid by any means. That's an awfully big sea scorpion.
Yeah.
And a very big arthropod. I really think those limits are If they're exceeded, they won't be exceeded by very much, either for trilobites or for the non-mineralized eurypterids or many of their other arthropods that are around. The world's biggest arthropods today, strictly measured in terms of dimension, are big spider crabs. And these are deep-sea-dwelling true crabs that have very, very long chelae. That's, again, big anterior legs that are have claws on the end of them that they use for feeding. And the maximum dimensions of these animals are always mentioned across, or measured across the big chelae, which are stretched out, and they're really big. Like, that's 4 meters across, some of these things. But the body is the size of a dinner plate. So body size for those is actually quite small. There are no bigger arthropods today. There are some big isopod crustaceans, some big amphipod crustaceans that are 40 centimeters, 50 centimeters in length. Some big land-dwelling crabs, which are horrendously big when you see them walking across the land towards you. Nothing, I think, given the constraints of living inside this exoskeletal box, all of the problems that are associated with getting bigger inside that box, which not only include just the metabolic issues of molting to get that big, but also operating muscles in an ever heavier and ever denser skeleton that's needed to support a larger animal, either in water or on land. I don't think we're going to get much bigger than that. A few centimeters, perhaps. I'd love to see a 75-centimeter trilobite. I'd love to see a meter-long trilobite.
Who wouldn't?
And we keep hoping, against hope, that nobody's going to find one bigger than Isatelus rex. These Portuguese fossils are really starting to push the limits there. But I'm not going to bet on it. I think we're probably near the limits for arthropods as we see them in the fossil record now.
Well, that's an amazing story, Dave.
Yeah, I think it's great just how this giant, the biggest trilobite ever found, was found by accident.
I'm having a hard time imagining how, considering the place has been long known for trace fossils, that a 70-centimetre fossil could go unnoticed. After all, it's not exactly the smallest thing in the world.
Well, if you go into the Paleocast website under Ordovician, you'll find this episode and the supplementary material, including photos of the expedition provided for us by Dave Rudkin himself. And even though the fossil's pretty big, you'd forgive people for never having noticed it before.
I can't work out how Dave and his team managed to keep one eye on the tide, one eye on the lookout for polar bears, and still managed to get this trilobite out of the ground.
Well, I know they were happy to have found it, but there must have been something somewhere inside that said, oh God, we're going to have to dig this up and haul it all the way back over to the truck by hand. But luckily for the team, I guess, this is the biggest trilobite ever found, not the biggest ever arthropod.
Still, there must have been quite a job getting it to the truck. I mean, it goes to show the dedication of these guys.
Well, like the dinosaurs, these were giants of the day. It's great that Dave and his team managed to recover this amazing fossil. So arthropod giants are something neglected by the media, but I think they were just as spectacular as any dinosaur.
I'm sure this won't be the last time Paleocast visits Paleozoic arthropods. I've got an inkling you'll be keen to feature a Eurypterid episode.
Oh, I don't think it's any secret that I have a fondness for sea scorpions. And maybe I got to see a few on my American road trip. You'll just have to wait and find out.
Paleocast was brought to you by Dave Marshall with John Tennant and Joe Keating. It was made possible by funding from the Paleontological Society. Music was supplied by The Ocean Collective. Please visit paleocast.com for the supplementary material for this episode and for our archive of past programmes. Subscribe to our Twitter feed at Paleocast and like us at facebook.com/paleocast to get all the latest news.